think that we didn't watch the timing on that other tape too well. So you were talking about your mother eventually divorcing your father, and how did that go?
Well, I think what I was saying on the other tape was that after the war, when we all returned, his wife had died. She died about 4 days before the end of the war. She was on her way to Denmark, and the bus or the car or whatever mode of transportation she was in was bombed, and she was killed. His name is Eugene Poor, in Hungarian, Jenő Poor, and he and my mother finally did get married. She came to the United States. He did too. She divorced my father and married him, but she stayed very friendly with my father, who subsequently also married, but who died very young. He was 58 when he died in 1958.
Tell me, as a Hungarian, how did he, your stepfather, get to Westerbork?
He got to Westerbork because he had lived in Hungary, then in Vienna, and then moved to Amsterdam.
I see.
And he was picked up as a Hungarian Jew. As a matter of fact, he had tried to escape this by being baptized, and it didn't work. A lot of Hungarian Jews did that. They got baptized thinking they were automatically Catholic and Judaism was wiped out, but it didn't work that way. I must tell you that after the transport started...
You think?
Okay. After the transport started, the school session stopped, especially for those of us who were 13 or older. And we were required to do some work. And I had a friend who was a lab technician. She was in charge of a lab. Her name was Giza Wolf. She was from Vienna, and she was very charming. As a matter of fact, she got married in Westerbork. And
how did that
go? And I was at the wedding, and one of the poems in the little book is about them getting married.
When there was a wedding in Westerbork, how did that happen? Did you need permission, or
I don't know about that. I know they got married, and I don't remember whether it was a rabbi or a civil ceremony, but they did get married.
Mm-hmm.
And her husband's name is Harold Wall. It was something else in German, but he changed it to her. I think it was something else, Harold Wall. And they moved to California after the war. At any rate, because she was a lab technician, I was able to get a job in the lab that she was heading. And I was trained at age not even 14 to be a lab technician. I learned to do urine analysis, and I learned to do blood testing. And after a while, I was sent around the hospital taking blood from patients' fingers. And to think that I was able to do that at 14 was quite amazing. And I enjoyed that work. It was with doctors and with other lab people, mm-hmm. and it was a good job. It was considered a very good job. And I stayed with that till we went to Belgium.
And your parents kept on at their work?
And my parents kept on their work, and my brother did go to some sort of a school program at times. It wasn't very regular.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't very regular.
But there was no cruelty, no beatings, no anything that identifies a concentration camp going on to the Jews at that time?
I can only speak for our family. There was nothing as far as we were concerned. I know that in the barracks where my parents were, where it was very crowded, where my mother and Jenő were, it was very crowded, and there were some altercations between people, between Jews themselves. I don't know whether the Germans actually came in and, you know, did anything. Not as far as I know, I'm sure when the transports left on Tuesday and Thursday, there was pushing and shoving at least. I mean, there may have been more, but I did not go to those. I did at one point go get up on a Tuesday morning very, very early, like at 4 a.m, because a friend was to be shipped to Auschwitz, and he was alone, and his name, I think, was Avi or Abi Abram, and I was very, very fond of him, and I brought him food to take on this trip, and I did see him. And this was one of the very few times that I actually went to the train early in the morning to see people.
And that train came right into the camp.
Yes, there was a railroad track that ran right in.
Were they frightened when they were going to
Russia? Yes, they were petrified. Mm-hmm. you'd be too.
Of course.
Yes.
So they seemed to have some idea that they were going to something pretty horrible.
Yes, because most of the time the trains were not regular, you know, trains with window seats and windows. These were cattle cars.
Did the people who knew they were going in the transport ever think at any time about escaping? Was there any of that?
I'm sure they all thought about it, but you see, the camp was surrounded with very high barbed wire fences, and there were outposts all over with Germans and machine guns, so there wasn't that much. There was probably an escape attempt here and there, but I don't remember.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember.
Mm-hmm.
I remember of one in Belgium, but I don't remember one in Vestergaard. Mm-hmm. I also think that I've blacked out so much that I don't remember because of that.
I could understand that. I could understand
yeah.
that. It's so such a frightening, horrible experience, because you talk about it living in such an unnatural situation. So naturally that I could well believe that you must have blocked out a good bit of it. So now these transports are going. The people who had hunks of paper that permitted them to stay felt relatively safe.
They felt that time was on their side, because the longer you were in Vestergaard, the better off you were. But as time went on, and they cleaned out the cities in Holland, and the Jews were moved east to Auschwitz, there were fewer and fewer left, and that's what happened. Finally, they got to the people with all the papers, and instead of sending them to Auschwitz, they sent them to places like Theresienstadt and to Bergen-Belsen and other places.
Mm-hmm.
My friend Jo Zeilman,
mm-hmm.
She went to Theresienstadt, after which she went to Auschwitz, after which I saw her again in Bergen-Belsen.
Mm-hmm. What made a person be selected for Theresienstadt and then moved, and then moved again?
I don't know.
No rhyme or reason
no.
that you know.
Theresienstadt was supposed to be, you know, less threatening, less horrendous than Auschwitz. Everything was better than Auschwitz. And so maybe what they did, I don't know. But I suppose that they may not have had enough room for everybody at once to Theresienstadt, so they gave the impression that you were going to something that was a little better. And then when they had room in Auschwitz, when they,
mm-hmm.
you know, they would ship them to Auschwitz. This is a conjecture. I do not know. I don't know how they arranged it. But I know that people going to Theresienstadt felt they were better off than going to Auschwitz.
Your parents and their particular jobs at the camp, did that make them feel any more secure?
Up to a point.
Up to a point.
Yes.
And then?
And then we were selected to go to Belsen, because we had the papers, the affidavits for Israel. So at that point...
How did that tie up with going to Belsen?
Belsen was a camp where they had people with all different kinds of papers, as I told you, the Paraguay passport, the Israel affidavit, and I don't know what else. All sorts of exceptions.
So that's what qualified you for that?
Yes.
And how long did you know in advance that you were going, or did they just come and say tomorrow?
I don't know, maybe a day or two.
Maybe a day or two. So, you got your things together?
Yes.
And you went?
We went. That was February 15, 1944. Went to Belsen.
Now tell me about that.
Belsen is in North Germany. It's not too far from Hanover, which is not too far from Hamburg. It's in the northwestern part of Germany. It's flat, very mm-hmm. flat country, as was Westerbork.
Mm-hmm.
It was not a very long road. I don't remember. 6 hours, 7 hours.
Mm-hmm.
No idea. And this was not in cattle trains. This was in a regular coach.
Mm-hmm.
And we went there. And when we got there, we were greeted by the people in charge at the section of Belsen where we were going to be. Belsen was gigantic, and different sections were surrounded by barbed wire, so one section of the camp couldn't see the couldn't go to the other section. We were
when you say gigantic, how gigantic?
Maybe, I don't know, more than 50,000. I'm guessing, but I would imagine at one point that is possible.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe a little less, but it was, it was enormous.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but it was not all Jewish. There were Polish criminals. There were gypsies. There was a section of Hungarian Jews.
Very
cool. Saw her. Afterwards I knew she was very close to where I was. We were in a Jewish section, and the top dogs in that section were Greek. There were Greek Jews from Salonika, and they were in charge. They were the big machers. Why? Because they were there first. Okay? So you had to be very friendly with them. I remember there was a woman that was the milk lady. She gave milk to children and teenagers and pregnant women, of whom there were very few. But you had to speak to her, and you had to do it in French. Madame, un peu de lait. All right? And she would say, oui, or non, or whatever. And you'd say, ah, madame, un peu, a little bit. And she would say, demain, tomorrow, come back. Or she would say, all right, today. But it was, that's where I did a lot of speaking. You know, you had to speak French
mm-hmm.
in that part of the camp, because the Greeks were in charge, and they spoke Ladino, they spoke Greek, and many of them spoke French.
Mm-hmm.
Then they had Jews coming into that section from Tripoli, in Africa, right? Why, I don't know, because I was Italian, and the Italians shipped them, and those people were pretty cold, because they've never been in a cold climate. So they didn't need to do much for them to die. All they had to do was not give them enough warm clothes, not give them enough food, and they'd drop like this. So this was a very international section of Belgium. They did not have gas chambers. They had work commandos, they had work groups. I worked every day.
What did you do?
Different kinds of work. At one point, I was in charge of children's daycare center, as it were, all right? People would have little children, the mothers would work. I would be babysitter, 10, 20, 30, whatever number. At another point in time, I was in a factory. We made some sort of material for the war effort, for the Germans. It was plastic piping that had to be woven in a certain way. It was like braided in five different ways. And I truly don't know what it was for, but it went on for hours and hours. You had to sit and do the braiding. Those were my main jobs. And you worked all day, and at that time I was 15. And the barracks were lousy. They were cold in the winter and very hot in the summer. It was triple deckers, and it got so crowded that you had to have two in a bed. At that point, there was a lot of disease because of lice, and a lot of people got typhoid. I had it twice. I had one case that was called paratyphoid. And then at the end of the war, after we were freed by the Russians, I had typhoid. typhoid fever. Also had, let me get yelling. Jaundice. Had that twice. So that was life in Belgium, which was much less.
You were not living with your parents then, they were?
I was living with my mother and my brother. My father was in a barrack for men. They separated men and women, and there wasn't much family life. I mean, you did get together for meals once in a while, and they would bring in the big containers, and the main staple was turnips every day. A year and a half turnips once a day. And you did get some soup the second meal, and in the morning some sort of coffee substitute as a And that was it. You got
the sanitary,
a slice of bread.
Yeah.
Sanitary, to a certain degree, we went to bath houses and they would turn on the water and you would take showers in hot water. And this was maybe once every so often. I don't even remember
what
it
about
was
the bathroom.
A month or so. And there were long lines with sinks and toilets. And no, toilets were outhouses. But they didn't have bathrooms and sinks. And you could wash there. But I remember very often in the coldest winter months that we would use the coffee instead of to drink it to wash ourselves. Because it was hot.
And your mother and father did what kind of work?
Yeah, my mother was in charge of the barracks there too, and my father, he had all sorts of jobs, and I do not remember exactly what he did. But I know it was a hard physical labor at one point.
Was there any threat of Jewish life existing there? Was there any?
Yes, there was. We would have our little meetings, which were, you know, an outgrowth of this youth group in Westerbork. We would have that once in a while, but it wasn't as often, it wasn't as nice. And I know one group would make little matzahs for Passover. They got some milk and, I mean not milk, but some flour and water, and they would make little matzahs over a fire, but it was really enough. No, there were no services, there were no meetings, not that I know of.
And family and friends, did any of them ever turn up? Did you with their leave?
Well, my father was in the same camp, he was just in men's barracks, I mean.
No, people from the other camp that you would, or people that you had known in Holland, did you?
Yes, once in a while, say when another transfer came. Actually, from Westerbork, I only remember that there were two or three after us, and that was it. And so, yes, people would turn up, and you would see each other.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of them would die, and you would be aware of, you know. And they died because of starvation, and because of lack of medical facilities, and because of lack of will to live, I think.
Well, when you came down with a paratyphoid and
yes.
the jaundice, were you given medical treatment?
No. No. Not in Belgium.
Not in Belgium.
Mm-hmm. I was sick with the paratyphoid for weeks and weeks and weeks. Maybe 7, 8 weeks. As a matter of fact, after that was done, very close to the end of my illness, it was the end of the war practically. And we were told to move out of the camp and go on another train, which was supposed to go to Auschwitz, and I had to walk, and I remember that 7 kilometers after I had lost a lot of weight, and I was extremely sick, made it.
Mm-hmm. Was the news seeping down into Belsen about what was happening?
To a certain extent, we had a lot of bombardments around the area, not in the camp, although at one point, a British plane strayed and did hit the camp a little bit. It killed one woman, and she's standing next to me. Next to me, as close as you stand to me,
oh
she was hit, and I was not.
you could well wonder what
it was.
Were you guarded by Germans in the camp?
Yes, constantly. My grandparents were also in that camp.
Oh, tell me about your grandparents. They had gone to...
My grandparents had come to Holland, and they stayed in Amsterdam much longer than my parents and brother and I, but they finally were sent to Westerbork, and they came with us to Belsen. I believe we all came together. My grandfather died of a heart attack in June 44. My grandmother held on pretty well and at one point did not have to go to the Appell, which is the which was the morning exercise, the morning call where you had to line up five in a row. And so she was exempt from that because she was over 65 or whatever the age was. And so she could stay in bed. And I remember very clearly that I, on a very cold morning, hid under her covers not to go outside. And an SS came in and he pulled the covers from her and there I was. And he could have done all sorts of things and I just gave him a little smile and said, I wouldn't do it anymore. And he let me go.
Mm-hmm.
But that was pretty risky. It was,
yes, it was.
Yeah, it was pretty risky. But then you did a lot of things that were pretty risky.
Mm-hmm.
But this was one of them. My grandmother did get very sick. And towards the end, was really bedridden. This was, you could see she didn't have much longer to go. And she also went on the train that we went on to go to Auschwitz, which was in April 45, and she died 3 days before the end, before we were freed. She died a day after President Roosevelt died, and we got the news that he died, and she knew it, and after he died, she died. It was just before the end of the war.
Do you make any connection between his death and her death?
Yes. To a certain degree, because he was her hero, and she always... Oh,
why
God,
was he her hero?
She felt that Roosevelt would win the war and we would all get out.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, Roosevelt didn't help the Jews very much, or the American government. Either powerless or unable or unwilling.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell me, were there guards other than Germans?
Yes, there were KAPOs.
Tell me about
KAPO. These were the Polish convicted criminals who were acting in behalf of the Germans. And they were extremely cruel. And they would guard the camp. And you needed to be on good terms with them. A number of the women went to sleep with them to be able to save their skin, practically their lives, because they were tough. They were mean, they were tough, and they had nothing to lose.
Were any of the guards, either Germans or the KAPOs, civil at any point to the prisoners? Can you remember any kindnesses?
I don't know particular kindnesses, but I would imagine that there must have been something because it wasn't total harassment at all times to everybody, but I don't know. I really don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I was lucky when I was discovered and he didn't beat me and he didn't kick me.
Mm-hmm.
So I must say at that point, you know, he was not cruel.
Mm-hmm. Would you just briefly review the routine in the camp, the daily routine? You got up at what time? You did what?
I know we got up early and we did get some of this hot brew and you got approximately a slice of bread to go with it. If you sliced the bread thin enough, you couldn't have.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, very often there was the call, the appel. And you had to go outside in cold and rain and snow and ice and heat. And you had to line up five in a row. This was done evidently to get war crews together. And also so they could see who was where. Now, I don't know, I don't even remember whether it was done every single morning or most mornings, but I remember it was often.
Mm-hmm.
There were days when it was done twice a day, morning and night. But again, I don't know how often.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, very many of the people would go to work. They would go to their work detail, like I would go to the place where they make plastic,
mm-hmm.
whatever. And my mother would take care of the barracks, my father would go whatever job he had. And my brother would sort of wander around or be in a group where they took care of children.
Mm-hmm. Were there many children in the camp?
Well, there were quite a few, I don't know about how many. And most of them did reasonably well, some died.
Mm-hmm.
But the kids, for the most part, did reasonably well.
Do you know of any religious services or
no.
that were held? Or
I don't know. I don't
know.
Groups? But then, don't forget, probably there were more of them in the men's barracks too, because a lot of the Orthodox men, you know, would have their prayers. But I don't know when anyway.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
I'm going to turn this table into the other side, and I think we're kind of getting to the end. there any, or was there any particular leader in the camp, any figure in the camp who helped the others to kind of hold on and rally?
Yes, the leader for the particular section that we were in was the man who had been our neighbor in the little suburb where we first lived, who was my father's business partner. His name was Joseph Weiss, and he was a very kind man. He was very highly respected by everybody, and he was the leader for the German and the Dutch Jews. There was a leader of the Greek Jews. He was a big, handsome, tough sort of a guy. And I don't remember his name. Lacouris or something of that sort. I don't remember. So they were various leaders, but they worked together.
What did they offer you that helped to sustain you?
They were able to make some contact with the Germans that evidently benefited us from the point of view that they would, from my understanding, assure them that we would cooperate, but would they please, you know, let the sick people lie down, and would they give some medical help, or I don't know.
Sort of intermediaries.
Yes, it probably is described in that book, which I'm going to bring today, of the destruction of the Dutch Jews.
Mm-hmm. And were there any spiritual leaders there, people who spiritually kind of lifted you out of despair?
I don't remember.
You don't remember that. Where were you when you were liberated?
I was in a small German town called Tröbitz, which was near Leipzig.
Well, how did you get there?
We were told in April 45 that we had to leave, and we knew that the war was close to an end. There were some reports that seeped in. So we were told to go on a train, and the rumor had it that we were going to go to Auschwitz. And as I told you before, we had to walk 7 kilometers. My friend Jo Zeilman was in another section of the camp, but we were able to get together, and I asked her to come with us, and she was afraid to, and she told me recently, after I left, she was so upset that she didn't go with us.
Her family were not there?
She lost everybody. Anyway, we walked the 7 kilometers and reached a station or a platform with a train that was cattle cars.
Now the Germans were supervising this exit.
Oh, they sure were, yes. Okay. There were several hundred of us, German Jews, Dutch Jews, French Jews. They also came. A lot of French Jews were in our reception. Greek Jews,
Belgians, I guess.
I don't know about Belgians. I don't know. But it was a whole conglomeration of people, a lot of languages. We got on the trains, and I remember sitting on the platform before going in, and it was the only time in all these years that I broke down. I cried and I sobbed, and I thought I would never make it. But I got on the train.
Because you were so tired, or you thought it was just a culmination?
Because I was tired and I thought it was the end. I figured this is it.
And your parents were?
My parents were on the train. My grandmother was brought on the train somehow with some kind of transportation because she couldn't walk. We got on the train and it was a horrendous ride. It was from April 7th or 9th. Until April 23rd on the train.
Okay.
Every day we would be attacked by planes, or there would be alarms, and we had to hide.
Whose planes were they?
British, French, American, whatever. They didn't know who we were.
Mm-hmm.
We crossed the River Elbe on the way to Berlin. And we were in the middle of the river, and there was an alarm, and we couldn't go back, and we couldn't go forth, and we were told, this is it, guys. And I remember saying, the Shema Yisrael. We made it, but we weren't bound. We were in Berlin 2 days before it fell. Train stopped in Berlin, saw the destruction, and we moved on.
You didn't leave the train? You would leave
We left the train in certain places, not in Berlin.
But as the trip went along, you could get
off? We got out because we had to find food. We ate raw potatoes, we ate whatever we could get.
They were under no obligation to feed you.
They
fed yourself.
They couldn't give us enough food because they didn't know where to get it from, evidently. They weren't interested in getting it. We were in one town, we were in one town where suddenly there was an alarm again, and everybody had to get out of the cars. And I lost my family, and I ran, and I hid under a locomotive, and then I thought, that's stupid. And I ran, and I ran away, and just as I was running away, maybe 100 yards, the whole locomotive was hit, and it blew up. And that's the kind of trip it was. We did not have places to wash, so we at one point stopped at a little lake or a pond, and many, many people would bathe together in this little lake.
How many people were on this train, Eugene?
I would say it was 600 to 800, but many of them died, and more of them died after we were liberated.
So then finally this train ended where?
The train ended. Can you step a minute? I have a... Kittens.
About 600 or 800 people, you think, on
yes.
the train.
However, yeah. after we were freed in Trebitz,
how do you call that?
T-R-O umlaut B-I-T-Z.
Yes.
Many of them contracted the typhoid, and many of them died after the liberation.
You don't know who was responsible for your liberation.
Yes, I know exactly who was responsible. The Russians. We were liberated by two young Russian soldiers on horses.
Tell me about that.
This was the 13th or 14th day, and the train stopped, and it was early in the morning, and we could see the Germans, and there were not that many by then, and they had white flags, and two Russian soldiers appeared on horses, and that was the liberation. And we couldn't understand them, and they couldn't understand us, but we knew we were free.
And then what happened?
Then, through some people who did know Russian, we were told that we should go to the nearest town, which was Turbitz, and find ourselves apartments, which we did. We were told the Germans would leave, or they would make room for us, so we would have housing. I went and found an apartment for my family. They said...
Did you have to displace someone to find...
Actually, I didn't have to displace. They lived downstairs and they gave us the upstairs.
These were Germans?
Germans. So they made room.
Did they do this willingly or angrily?
Yes, because they knew if they didn't, they were going to be shot. So they did it quickly. So we moved in, and the next day we went and looked like scavengers, looked for food. We found a German abandoned army train with enormous supplies of food, especially cheese, and we took it back. We also, the man I was going with to find this, he and I killed rabbits, and we had rabbits. Do and we ate, and we all got sick promptly because it was too much. After that, a lot of us got typhoid, and even though we'd been inoculated, evidently wasn't strong enough at that point, and many, many people died right after being liberated.
Where were you cared for?
The Russians set up a hospital, They gave excellent care. As a matter of fact, they took my brother because he was very, very sick. I was terribly sick too, but they took him away and they cared for him, shaved his hair, and he recuperated. My father was very sick. I took care of him. He had a heart attack in addition to having typhoid. My mother was very sick. I took care of everybody, and then I got it, and I got it worse than they did. Really was near death, but I made it, and then two Russian soldiers wanted to come and take me with them, and I kept saying typhoid, typhoid, and that sort of scared them off, but otherwise I think, I'm sure, they would have taken me
as a tour.
To rape me.
The Russians?
Yes, but they didn't. We stayed in this little town for about 6 weeks. One of the people who died there was the wife of Joseph Weiss. She died there, along with many of us. And after 6 weeks, the Americans came in and said they would resettle us back in the West, first in the western part of Germany, and then into Holland. This trip took many weeks because the roads were poor condition or bridges were blown up. But we did finally make it back to Holland.
Did you get together with any of your family that you had
had no family in Holland? When we got back to Holland, we stayed at the house of some friends who had been with us in Belsen, named Pearlberg, and we roomed there for several months.
Was there any contact with Jewish agencies, like the...
Oh, there were lots of contacts. Once we were on the way, you know, repatriated, the American Jewish agencies, the American governmental agencies, everybody did whatever they could.
Mm-hmm.
Then we were taken care of.
So how long did you stay in Holland before coming here?
I was in Holland. I got back in July 45 and I left in July 46. A year.
A year. Did someone...
Went to school.
How did you... Who guaranteed your admission to the United States?
The Quakers.
The Quakers.
I was admitted... I was the first European student to be admitted to a Quaker school after the year.
And your parents also came under their aegis?
No. Yeah. My mother came as a visitor, I came as a student, my brother was sent to boarding school in Switzerland, my father stayed in Holland, so that the family was completely split up then.
Did your father stay in Holland by choice, or?
Yes, because he assumed my mother was coming back, because she went to the United States as a visitor, but then she wrote him she would divorce him and marry Leonard Poor.
Who had gotten to the United States?
Yes,
had they been in contact with
him? Oh, yes. After the war.
After the war.
Yes.
And then he eventually came to the United States, your father?
My father married a Dutch woman, and they came to the United States, and they lived in California, and they were very good friends with Gisa and Harold Wall, the one who I worked with in the laboratory.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yes, and I'm in touch to this day with people that I was in Westerbork with, or in Belgium.
Mm-hmm. And then your brother and you eventually stayed, and your mother stayed also?
My brother arrived in 1947 as a student, and he was admitted to the same boarding school that I'd been to.
Mm-hmm.
He also came as a student to go to Quaker school.
Well, Erica, I think that kind of ends our soiree. I'm so sorry that second tape really was not good.
Okay. In closing, I think I should say that you're a very good interviewer.
Thank you.
And while it was painful, I think it has to be said, I personally am of the opinion that it's very important not to forget what happened during the Holocaust. I'm also of the very strong opinion that certain people or certain institutions are using the Holocaust to a financial benefit that I do not agree or subscribe to.
For instance?
I don't like to name names.
Okay.
I think that...
Are you talking about people who are writing books, who are...
I think there are certain people who have made the Holocaust their livelihood or their profession.
Mm-hmm.
And I just find it some... I know I could not do this
mm-hmm.
at this point.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying never, because you can never say never, but I find this somewhat distasteful. I think it has a place in history, and I think I've made my contribution. I would very strongly urge those who are putting this together to use my poems simply as a record. They are not to be published, they are not to be translated by anybody without my permission. I think basically I would give, I gave this interview to remember those that didn't make it. And that's really what it's all about. We're here and we go on. And this interview is sort of in memory of those who didn't survive.
Erica, just one more. Because you know, you are so clear in what you say and your convictions. Do you think it could happen again?
I think anything is possible. I think that the same thing couldn't happen identically. I don't think it's an identical thing. I do believe that many similar events have already happened and the world has taken very little notice of them. I would point out Kampuchea, for one, and Afghanistan, and these are two examples that certainly are tremendous tragedies, the loss of human life, we don't know the number, but it runs into many hundreds of thousands, and we're not taking any active role in that. Whether it can happen to Jews again, I would imagine things can happen. I don't think ever to the degree. I think the state of Israel is, in a way, our hope for something not happening.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think that cruelty will continue forever. And that's a terrible pessimistic thing to say, but I've seen nothing to indicate that people are less cruel in 1982 than they were in 42, maybe some different methods. On the other hand, I also think there is always hope, and I'm a great optimist by nature. And I feel that even throughout this horrendous experience, had it not been for my strong hope, I would have never made it. And I do look for good things in any situation. And I told you earlier that some of the things in Vesterbork, as crazy as it sounds, they were good for me in a certain way. Not that I was in Vesterbork, but some of the connections I made and some of the experience I had.
And your alignment with Judaism, your...
Yes, yes. So that there were some things that weren't totally horrendous. They were, you know, I had some good times, and I don't mean to say that, the experience in general was good, no, but there were some snips of it that were definitely good because I met some wonderful people and did some very interesting things and joyful things.
Now let me ask you, your experiences as a young girl.
Yes.
Would you venture what your mother might have said in conclusion? Would she have echoed your kind of feeling, or do you know if she subscribes to a different point of view?
I think my mother has also blacked out a great deal, maybe even more than I have. And I'm quite sure she would subscribe to that too. I don't even know that she would be willing to be interviewed. Mm-hmm. I don't know. My parents and my mother and stepfather have tried to let the past be the past, and they went forward. And they visited Austria and Switzerland and Germany, fully aware of anti-Semitic tendencies there even to this day, but also aware that they enjoyed certain aspects of it as vacationers. And that's all they were. They were on vacation and they enjoyed certain amenities and certain parts of that. And they do not wish to be awakened again and again over what happened. Mm-hmm. They know it happened. I'm sure there are certain guilt feelings. I'm sure there are certain scars. My stepfather had nightmares for years. But they have buried it to a large degree.
And what about their feeling of Jewishness, their feeling for the state of Israel? Let's put it
Their feeling for the state of Israel is very positive philosophically, and they would make contributions, but they do not have a personal involvement. My brother also has buried much of it, and he was so young that his experience is again different. My brother Ernest Hilton, he changed his name from Hertz to Hilton. He was married.
Why did he do that?
Because he felt it would be better for business, and he changed it a long time ago. He was married to a woman from Australia for 15 years.
A Jewish woman?
No. And he divorced her, and he is presently happily married to a woman from Thailand by the name of Saisampan Svarna Pradeep, and they have a son, a year and a half old. And I think my brother is in a unique position. My brother was the first to be bar mitzvah in Holland after the war. And I would...
Whose idea was that?
My parents. And I would imagine...
Well, that was a switch for your parents, wasn't
no,
it?
No, that was not. That was part of it. I mean, bar mitzvah
was a ritual.
Yes. Mm-hmm. He was the first to be bar mitzvah in Holland after the war, and he probably is the last, or one of the last, to have a baby from the people who were in Kent.
Mm-hmm.
His baby was born a year and a half ago.
Mm-hmm.
And that was his first and only child.
Mm-hmm.
So that he has two records,
mm-hmm.
the first bar mitzvah and the last to become
mm-hmm.
a father.
Well, that lets
yes.
us end on a positive
yes.
rebirth.
Okay,
thanks, Erica, a million.
Erica Van Adelsberg called me about 2 hours after our interview to express her concern that she had not indicated to us that she had married in 1955. In 1957, had a daughter, Judith, who is now Judith Berman, married to Michael Berman, and she is currently working on her PhD in Israel at the Weizmann Institute. In 1960, her son David was born, and he is presently completing his studies at Drexel University in Philadelphia.